Yeah, I don't mind if people don't come. I'm just curious, well, where did they go? They have another place to learn.
One of those days.
Yeah. Actually, the old Lucina. Yeah.
I've heard about this thing called the Slifkin Affair.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what that is and, you know, all the angles and all that jazz.
Well, Rabbi Slifkin, who used to teach, used to be a Rebbe in our synagogue. He's a young fellow, maybe late 30s. And he has a specialty. Among his specialties are he's very interested in the animal kingdom. In fact, he's the rabbi of the Jerusalem Zoo, and he does all sorts of stuff with animals, which is, you know, that's innocuous and interesting. That's not the controversy. And in the course of his interest in zoology, he began to explore the various conflicts and problems between Chazal and Torah and science, such as age of the earth, whether evolution, different statements in Chazal about spontaneous generation, that means that life can come out of inanimate matter, which Chazal seemed to assume, and it contradicts modern science. And he was trying to develop an approach as to how do you understand Torah, which is absolute truth, when it seems to contradict the science as we know it. So he wrote a few books about science and religion. They certainly used to be in the library here. I'm not sure if they still are, because in light of the issue I'm going to discuss in a moment. And rabbis gave him haskalas. In other words, you know, different rabbis read his books, you know, Rosh Yeshivas, and they approved it. But what happened was, at some point in the process, there were people primarily in Eretz Yisrael who looked at the books and considered them to contain heretical ideas. In particular, Rabbi Slifkin rested on the premise that in matters of science, Chazal were not speaking as Bali Masora, but they were simply expressing the wisdom that was known in the world, and that could be wrong and erroneous, and that doesn't change halakha. But it's not, in other words, he was dividing between Chazal, who are, when they're expressing scientific realities, versus halachic realities. Now, the truth is, he had many sources for this. The Rambam, very eminent, Rambam, etc., Pygon, and the like. But it was thought by some people that that would undermine respect for Chazal. If they're wrong here, they can be wrong there. So as a result, there were different people who tried to get different Gedolim to either put the books in Cherem or declare them to be Bikus or the like. And such letters were issued, but it's a very, very messy thing, because there is, you know, much proof that the Gedolim did not read the books. The books were in English, and only certain passages were translated in front of them, etc. So as a result, now what happened was, it had a spiraling effect, because as Rabbi Slifkin was under attack, he then unfortunately responded in more bitter ways. So in some ways, the way he responded to an attack was actually worse than the thing for which he was being criticized in the first place. So the net result is, I'm just trying to be as objectively reporting as I can. I'm not, Dafka, not telling you any opinion on it at this point, is that within the Haredi Yeshiva Torah world, the books were declared not to be proper, in spite of the fact that there were haskamos initially. In fact, Rav Aaron Feldman actually went to the Rosh Yeshiva of Neri Yisrael, who approved of the books initially, actually went to Rebbe Yashiv to ask Rebbe Yashiv to reconsider the ban. He was not successful. So as a result, Rabbi Nachson Slifkin became Rabbi Natan Slifkin, and he is now quite popular in the more modern non-yeshivish community. And in fact, the band made more popular because, no, you know, he's whatever. You know, he is very bitter. And actually, in terms of the personal bitterness, I certainly understand it, because, you know, he was he is a very, very bright person and capable and very prolific for a person of a young age. And what he did initially with the haskama of many, many rabbanim. But then to be labeled as an apikoris, all right, same as so what did Rabbi Yashiv say? He's not an apikoris, just the books are apikoris. All right, make chilukim like that. Was very, very hurtful for him. So he more or less, I mean, he's totally totally religious, but he more or less left the yeshiva world and now lectures only within the modern Orthodox community. Now, the issue is this. There are a lot of issues in terms of the actual issues of the Slifkin affair. There are a lot of issues. For example, I'll point out, for example, Rabbi Gottlieb. Let's take Rabbi Gottlieb. Rabbi Gottlieb is a professional philosopher. Now, if you went to Rabbi Gottlieb's website 10 years ago, I don't know if he had a website, but whatever, you would see that he would make all sorts of arguments about the age of the earth and the possibility of evolution and the fact that the length of a day is uncertain. I mean, I remember this. I know this because I remember this. If you go to the website now, you will see that all of that has changed. And basically, because he felt that if the Gedolei HaDor's approaches are no longer considered to be acceptable, then he was not going to use them anymore. He was going to try to work within the framework that the Gedolim approved of. There was a change, literally, a change, turning out a dime, because, and again, that's to his credit, in a sense, because the Gedolim say some approaches that people thought were good were not considered valid, and the like. But the truth of the matter is, this is not at all so pashut, because there are, in fact, some very good Makoros that talk about the possibilities of evolution and the age of the earth, and there are passages in Kabbalah that say that the world is older than 5,773 years. You can measure it different ways. And Slifkin himself had Makoros from Rishonim. Now, Rav Yoshev Tainet, and this is the interesting issue, Rav Yoshev Tainet, a fascinating idea, that it could be that a thought that was expressed by somebody 1,000 years ago would not have been Apikorsis, because a psak was not settled on it. But once the consensus of Gedolei Yisrael is that a certain idea is wrong, it now becomes apikorsis to resuscitate it. Now, this is a fascinating, interesting philosophical halachic problem, and that is, we understand the concept of psak halacha in what you do. Right? So there's a machlokes beshamay and beshilel, if something is tohor, something's tameh. So even though Beis Shammai could have followed Beis Shammai because there was no final decision, it's a davar pashut, I'm not allowed to follow Beis Shammai. But apikorsis is not referring to how you behave, it's referring to what is the truth or falsity of a given belief. You know, did God make the world in 6 days, or did God make the world in 6 billion years? Now, if you're telling me 1,000 years ago, it's possible to believe that, because maybe it was true, then how is it shayach for there to be a psak that it's a false belief? In other words, some have said it's not shayach, it's not possible, the concept of psak halacha on matters of faith, because matters of faith either are or are not. In other words, they're true or they're not true, and therefore their truth or falsity does not change based on a psak. So that's one issue. So as I say, it's a very, very controversial issue. My personal shita on this, all of this, is that, and I've said this before, that particularly in Eretz Yisrael, statements of apikorsis, of kfira, these types of statements are frankly hyperbole. And they're hyperbole to discourage people from pursuing certain lines of thought on the grounds that it may undermine their faith. But they're not technically apikorsis, and for some people privately, these approaches might still be valid. In other words, when something is labeled apikorsis, it just means we think it is not a proper pedagogical approach for the broad-based public, but there might be individuals that may need to understand things in that way. Now, that is my understanding of these types of bans. Other people will disagree, because they'll say that's not what the ban says. The ban is written in a much stricter way, but I actually believe this very, very strongly. Let me give you a little analogy. I'll give you two analogies. One is a trivial story, which is not a Torah story, although it's about a gadol, and the other is actually a story in Das Torah itself. I think I may have told you the story about Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky and the diet, that a doctor once put him on a diet, and he was losing too much weight. And the doctor said, oh, that's because you're following the diet. I gave you the diet with the understanding that you would eat double the amount, as most people do. Chachamim are this way, in Eretz Yisrael in particular. Things are excommunicated with the expectation that at least people aren't going to be teaching it publicly. Because if they would just say, don't teach it publicly, they would cross a line. The other story, which is the same story, really. Well, actually, I'll tell you a new story, because I just heard a new story yesterday that makes the same point. So in case I don't want to repeat something, I'll tell you a new story. That there was a shaila in the 1950s. You know, in Eretz Yisrael, there is a branch of chadarim, elementary schools, that are called Chinuch Hatzmai. Chinuch Hatzmai does get some government money, but it is not controlled by the government at all. In other words, Chinuch Hatzmai literally means independent education that is not controlled by the government. And this has been in existence, you know, since the founding of the state of Israel. Now, there are also religious government schools. These are called Mamlachti Dati. Okay, and those who are more religious don't like Mamlachti Dati because the government mandates the curriculum and it's a more modern school and the like. Now, in some development towns, particularly in the 50s, a community could not support two schools. So sometimes there was some discussion about a merger, to merge or combine a Chinuch Hatzmai school with a Mamlachti Dati school. Right? And this was a problem. So somebody went to the Brisker Rav, the great Gadol, the Brisker Rav, to ask the Brisker Rav if they asked Rav Shach first, and Rav Shach said, "Let's go to the Brisker Rav." So the Brisker Rav, you know, heard this thing about combining schools. And this Brisker Rav started yelling and being critical. The Brisker Rav says, "Chas v'shalom, what are you talking about? You know, how could you do that? How could you take a pure Torah chinuch and adulterate it, you know, with these modern schools that are secular ideas and the government controls it?" He says, "How could you even think of such a thing?" So the person is really trembling at the fact that he even brought it up to the Brisker Rav. And he goes to Rav Shach and he tells Rav Shach the whole story. And Rav Shach says, "Okay, so the Brisker Rav says you can combine the schools." He says, "Huh? What are you?" He says, and they combined the school. And like a year later, the Brisker Rav was asking, "So how's the school going in this town?" And the person was afraid to say that we merged. He says, "Well, you know, we merged it." The Brisker Rav says, "Ah, why did you merge it after our conversation?" And now the guy's even more frightened. He says, "Rav Shach said to do it." The Brisker Rav says, "Ah, Rav Laser always understands me." Now, I hope this story makes sense to you. I hope you get what's going on. Meaning to say the following. Just to tell people, go ahead and do it, so people take it for granted, they don't realize the risks, they don't take it seriously. The Brisker Rav wanted them to understand that this was a serious decision that had negative consequences, and it should only be undertaken if it's absolutely necessary. But in order to make that point, he had to say how bad it was. But Rav Shach, of course, who was a gadol in his own right, understood that the Brisker Rav was emphasizing how bad it was, just so when people enter, they enter with consciousness and awareness. It's a really great story. So, Lanias Daiti, and again, many people will disagree with me, so I'm not giving you any official Das Torah here at all. But Lanias Daiti, many of these excommunications in the Slifkin area are really very much the same. That there were certain dangers, certain approaches in which you make the Torah non-literal in certain areas could lead a person, chas v'shalom, to kafira. If you show disrespect for chazal in some areas, that could lead a person to disparage halacha. So the chayrim idea is these are approaches that are not going to be helpful for a lot of people. So even though the word was chayrim, that actually does not mean lanias daiti, that is totally illegitimate, but it means it's an approach that should be kept for special people, individuals, in special circumstances. Okay, I hope that gives you a general overview of what it is. So again, in terms of what happened to Rabbi Slifkin, it is a personal tragedy. Indeed, again, I mean, he suffered a tremendous amount, and as I say, his response to the criticisms has been disrespectful at times. I have to say, again, he has not behaved properly in that way. On the other hand, Chazal have an expression that a person is not always condemned for what he does when he's suffering. So I don't personally blame him. But in terms of the ultimate ideas in the book, I believe they are, I'm not saying they're correct approaches necessarily, but these are possible approaches in which Gedolim have identified that there are dangers in those approaches. But again, walking on a dangerous path doesn't mean you necessarily fall off the cliff, but it just means you have to proceed with it. Okay? Yeah.
I Speaking of Rabbi, reminded me of the Gemara. I think in Kedushin, which talks about a kinyan and an elephant.
Yeah.
And I think there's a Tosfos commentary that says one way of requiring it is to cause the elephant to jump, for the right foot is off the ground. And I'm studying veterinary medicine, and the people I've asked in the field, I think according to this current knowledge, it's not possible for elephants to jump.
Yes. Well, you know, the truth of the matter is, you can write a whole book. And in fact, by the way, there are webs. Maybe I shouldn't even mention it. I'm sure I'm not going to tell you the name of the website. I mean, there are websites of kaifrim and apikorsim and mesisim and madichim, mamish, people who say they were rabbanim. They don't give their name. Whose whole job is to point out, like, every Gemara that contradicts science, as well as a million other things, and to ridicule Chazal. This is Mamish Mesis Umediach Mamish, and to discredit Chazal. So you can make a whole book about all of these things, but there are different ways of understanding it. One way of understanding it is, Eino Chinami, when Chazal speak about science, they are certainly equal to the wisest of their age, but things change, just like the Rambam. The Rambam was a great doctor. And the Rambam in the Mishneh Torah gives you medical advice. Actually, some of the medical advice people still follow today, but some of it not. Now, the Gemara gives you medical advice, but the Rambam doesn't bring the Gemara's medical advice. The Rambam gives you his medical advice. So, the same way, the Rambam felt free to depart from the Gemara. So on scientific matters, you know, we can depart from the Rambam. In other words, unlike Torah, in which as we get further and further from Matan Torah, the Doros get worse, in technology and science, there can be an advance. So one approach is that Chazal are not necessarily speaking authoritatively on matters of science. That's one issue. This is what they thought. There is another approach that says, you know, who says elephants can't jump? We haven't seen it, you know. There are plenty of things we haven't seen yet, and we might discover things, right? Take a little needle and stick it on an elephant's foot and, you know, see what happens. I wouldn't want to be around there, but, you know, etc. So there are things that we don't know yet. And for example, you know, and this is true even in medicine. All sorts of herbal medicines, all sorts of plants that appear, you know, we didn't even know what these things can do. There's a third approach that says, although I can't answer the elephant example in particular, that sometimes we say the teva changes. That, in other words, the natural order was a certain way then, and Chazal's description was accurate, and then things changed in the course of time. In Hilchos Nida, we say that, for example. In the time of Chazal, women's periods were absolutely regular almost to the hour. In other words, every 30 days, 3 p.m. And that's why the whole structure of Hilchos Nida was based on absolute regularity of periods. That was the norm. And a woman whose periods were sometimes 29, sometimes 30, was considered to be an aberration. And yet today, it's absolutely the case that it's totally the opposite. A fixed period is extremely rare, and all of Hilchos Nida that we teach today is primarily based on the irregular period, right? Things like that. So you have three approaches. One is Chazal don't have to be right when it comes to science, but that doesn't take away their infallible standing as the transmitters of Torah Shebal Peh. The second approach is Teva changes, or that's the second. And the third approach is maybe our scientific understanding might be wrong. You know, it's very, very interesting. We shouldn't be so confident that we know so much that what Chazal said is not true. Now, there's a fourth interpretation. And that is, again, it doesn't explain everything. And that is the Maral. The Maral generally says that often when Chazal makes statements about the natural world, they are really metaphors or allegories about Ruchnius. It's when Chazal describe how the sun behaves or the moon behaves, they're really discussing inner spiritual realities, and it's not meant to be taken in a literal truth, right? So these are four different approaches, and for some things you'll use one approach, some things you'll use another approach. Now, what's interesting is, though, on one hand, you want to differentiate between, say, science and halacha. Right? All right, science, maybe Chazal are wrong, halacha, they have to be right, one way or the other. The question becomes this, though. The question becomes, what if you have a halacha that is based on a scientific assumption that modern science considers to be impossible. And let me give you the outstanding example. The outstanding example is the Gemara in Shabbos that says that on Shabbos you are allowed to kill lice. You're allowed to kill a louse on Shabbos because the prohibition of killing on Shabbos is only creatures that produce sexually by the union of a male and female. And since lice, the Gemara says, do not produce through sexual reproduction, they produce through the decaying and rotting of matter, you know, rotten food, i.e. what's called spontaneous generation, there is no Iser, says the Gemara, there is no Iser of killing lice. Now, here, this is a very unusual case, because Chazal are maturing something, based on spontaneous generation. They're maturing what would have been a malacha d'oraisa, based on spontaneous generation. Now the question becomes, well, if we have proven that there is no such thing as spontaneous generation, that lice do sexually reproduce, right? There's Mr. and Mrs. Louse there that get together. So the question becomes, does that change the halacha? Right? See, it's fine to say, oh, well, science is one way and halacha is the other. What if the halacha is based on a scientific premise? So this is a huge, huge machlokas. When spontaneous generation was more or less discredited in around, you know, 1600s, 1700s, so there was a discussion then among poskim whether that would change the halacha of harigas kina. There was a sefer Pachad Yitzchak, not to be confused with Rav Huttner's Pachad Yitzchak, much later. This was a Pachad Yitzchak from the 1700s. Actually says the halacha for sure changes. How can you be lenient if the science is a mistake? Others took the position, and this is a very interesting mystical position, that when Chazal or Machriya halacha, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives them the koach to come to the right decision, even if the reason they articulate turns out to be the wrong reason. Meaning, there might be a million reasons why killing a lice is permitted. Chazal picked one that happened to be wrong, but that doesn't change the integrity of their psak. Actually, it's reminiscent of a famous, much later story. Now, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was the greatest analytical gadol in terms of depth, and amkus and iyun, right? The whole notion of the iyun in all yeshivas today is from Rav Chaim's derech, although Rav Chaim's derech has been perverted in many ways, but the shayrish of it is Rav Chaim's derech. So Rav Chaim was a person, I mean, he was the gadol dar, but he was a person of unusual depth, even among gadolim. And he didn't like to paskin halacha, though. The paisei kador in Rav Chaim's time was Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who was the Paisei Kador. In fact, YU is named after him. Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. And Yitzchak Elchanan was not only the Gadol Ador in Psak Halacha, but he was also the Askin. He was the one that was the one who protected the Jews with the Tsar. I mean, he was the one that was involved in all of the Yiddishkeit in Russia. And Rav Chaim used to send Shailas to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, and he would say, this is the story, I don't know if it's true, he would say, just tell me the psak. Tell me, is it mutter or aser? Don't give me any reasons. What's the pshat? Because if you give me a reason, you give me a swara, I'll almost certainly be chaylik on your swara. Because Rav Yitzchak Elchanan had a different methodology of thought. But even if your swara is wrong, I know your answer is right. Because you're the paisek that Hashem has designated to guide us. Right? So one swara is halacha changes when the science changes, right? That's approach number one. Approach number two is the mystical approach, that in matters of halacha, Chazal got it right, even if their reason is wrong. And then there's a third approach of the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish has a very interesting approach. The Chazon Ish says, halacha is not based on actual metzias. Halacha is based on visually perceptible metzias. This is actually very, very interesting. Let's take insects, right? This is a big thing today, you know. Oh, you can't eat this vegetable, you can't eat strawberries because of bugs and everything. Now, we do know that, you know, every time you open your mouth, even to breathe, you're taking in all sorts of microbes and you know, little creatures that come in. That's why there's that religion, how do you pronounce it? The Jainists, it's J-A-I-N, I don't know how you pronounce it. But they wear these mesh masks over their nose and mouth, so they shouldn't breathe in any insects. And if you eat food, I don't want to take away your appetite, but, you know, unfortunately, you know, we are ingesting rat hairs and all sorts of disgusting things. You know, things that, you know, we would get sick if we were aware of it. Now, the question is, putting aside the disgust factor, it's usher, it's great. The answer is that the Torah does not usher things that you can't see. Things that are not visible to the naked eye are not nichlal in the isser. Because the Torah was not given to angels. Same thing with tefillin. Tefillin, right, the bias of tefillin has to be square. By the way, just a little aside, it doesn't have to be a cube, by the way. You can have, it can be tall. In other words, the bias can look like a stovetop hat, like, you know, the old Abe Lincoln hat. You can actually have a tall, and then as long as it's square on top. In fact, there actually is a shita now that's advising for bar mitzvah kids to have narrow, tall tefillin shell. Right? And the reason is because the problem with a bar mitzvah kid is if the kid is short, small, so a regular sized tefillin is really going beyond, right? It may go below the bicep because his arm is too small, and it may go below the hairline. LMI, to get him small tefillin, there's a problem, because if the tefillin are too small, it's very hard to write partials accurately, because the smaller the partial, like a mezuzah, it's harder to get it right and prevent letters from touching. So the solution that somebody came up with, again, this is just a digression, the solution somebody came up with is that you can actually make the tefillin taller than they are wider. So they're narrow, they're tall, but because they're tall, I mean, I don't mean that they're 5 feet high, I mean, you know, they're a little taller than usual, that allows you to write bigger partials, which are kosher, and then put them in. So I know that some people are mahader to get the taller tefillin. But be it as it may, they do have to be square, in other words, and if they got niskalkel in any way, that's a serious problem. But you don't have to examine tefillin under a microscope to determine that. If an average person looking at them visually sees square, that's good. So the Chazon Ish Tainis, if halacha does not deal with what you might call sub-visual phenomena, then that could be the explanation of the lice. And that is, yes, there is sexual reproduction, but since that is not perceptible to the naked eye at that point, so therefore, halachically, it is deemed as if it's spontaneous. Meaning, Chazal never made a statement about ultimate reality. They made a statement about perceptible reality. So the Chazon Ish Tainis, based on that, there is no contradiction between, at least in this context, between halacha and science, because science is addressing the actual reality, and halacha is addressing the perceptible reality, and the halacha does not change when the science changes, because the perceptible reality still remains the same. So there are a lot of approaches, ranging from Chazal were wrong, so the halacha changes, or Chazal have a mystical reason for things, even if they gave the wrong reason, or Chazal are dealing with perceptible reality. Okay, so that would kind of be... So the point is, there's not a single answer to any of this. But you have to go through every conflict, and then you have to figure out, you know, what might approach. Yeah.
There's a famous statement that Jechoniah Sacerdotal prayed for Avodah Zorah to be taken away.
Yeah.
Does that then mean that today Avodah Zorah Dafka doesn't exist? And if so, how do we relate to Catholicism and Hinduism?
Yeah. Well. Yeah. The truth of the matter is, yeah. This is the Gemara in Maseches Yuma that says that the 120 elders of the Ante Knesset Sagdola gathered together, and they actually prayed that Hashem should take away the Yetzer Hara for idolatry, and this was represented as a fiery lion that ran into the desert out of the Holy of Holies. And then they thought, oh, we got rid of that Yetzer Hara, so let's get rid of the Yetzer Hara of Gilui Arayos. Right? That'd be good. And what happened was, they got rid of that too, but then people didn't get married, they didn't have kids, so Chazal realized that you have to have some Yetzer Hara there, otherwise the world would not exist. So we are told that the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah has been taken away, so you're asking, well, are there not religions to this very day that are technically Avodah Zarah? So I think we have to understand the idea as following, that even if the Yetzer Hara was taken away, it doesn't mean it was totally destroyed. In other words, it means that it no longer has the same powerful attraction as it once did. In the time of the Tanakh, the Gemara says, the Yetzer Hara of idolatry was so powerful that, you know, Menashe was one of the evil kings of Am Yisrael. And the Chachamim were discussing that Menashe does not have a share in Olam Haba. So Menashe came to them in a dream, and Menashe said, ask me any Tatya B'chala Tera Kula that you don't understand. And he knew everything. Phenomenal Talmud Chacham, greater than any Gadol then. So they asked him in the dream, how could a man like you be Nichshol B'Avodah Zarah? And he said, if you were there, you would rip your clothes and scratch your legs, running through thorns and barbed wire, so to speak, to get to Avodah Zarah. So when we say they took away the Yetzer of Avodah Zarah, it means they took away the passion, but, you know, it'll still be residual, just like with cancer, you know, there might still be little patches here and there. But the Vilna Gaon says a fascinating thought. The Vilna Gaon says a thought that's really very, very deep. It needs a lot of explanation. He says the following, that when Hashem took away the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah, it was replaced by the Yetzer Hara for money. So if we want to know what it felt like to want to worship an idol, we have to look at how much people are, you know, giving up everything to make money. Now, the Vilna Gaon's point is a very deep point. Because, first of all, keep in mind the Gemara's imagery. How does the Gemara describe the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah? It describes it as a fiery lion that leaves the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Why would you describe idolatry as somehow residing in the Kodesh HaKadoshim? That almost implies that Avodah Zarah is holy, which of course, you know, Chas V'Shalom, the opposite is case. But the answer is, the Rambam writes in Hilchos Avodah Zarah, that the origin of Avodah Zarah, the origin of paganism, the origin of idols, the origin of worshipping other forces, actually came because people originally had, it degenerated later. They all knew there was one supreme God that created heaven and earth. But they had so much reverence for God, so much awe, that they felt it was a chutzpah for them to turn to God. Just like, you know, if you had trouble with your social security check in America, you're not going to go to Obama. You go to a local person. It's kind of a chutzpah. Right? Maybe in the United States people don't have so much respect, but, you know, you won't go to Queen Elizabeth or whatever the equivalent in England is going to be. So the Rambam says the initial impetus for Avodah Zarah was people felt unworthy to go to Hashem. It came from their Yiras Hashem. And their Yiras Hashem made them move away and think they should praise Hashem by worshiping the servants. So, here is the thing. The impetus for Avodah Zarah came from a very holy, elevated place, where you're so overwhelmed with Yiras Hashem that you feel you can't approach Him. But that's dangerous, because that leads you astray, away from Hashem. So, the nature of the Bittul of the Yitzra de Avodah Zarah is what you might call a spiritual lobotomy. Now, they don't do lobotomies that much today, but in the 50s and 60s and later, you know, a person had epileptic seizures. So one of the things they would do is they would cut out parts of the brain that were causing the seizures, literally cut out parts of the brain. Now, the problem is, of course, when you cut out parts of the brain, even if your operation is successful and you remove something bad, you've also removed something good. In other words, there'll be a change in mood. In other words, there would often be some type of deterioration. So what I'm suggesting the Gra is being meramis to is the beetle of the Yitzra, the Avodah Zarah, was a spiritual desensitization for the awe and reverence of the Shekhinah. So how many of us feel, I can't daven today because how dare I approach Hashem? How many of us are quaking and shaking and so afraid because we're overwhelmed? Most of us say, no, sure. If we want to daven at all, say, Hashem is my buddy, he'll listen to whatever I have to say. So this is what the Quran means, that the passion was taken away from Hashem, and now it lives on a much lower level. Money, gashmias, materialism. Meaning, we're no longer inspired with the holiness of Hashem. So, it's an amazing thing. Losing the Yetzirah of Avodah Zarah was a reduction, a diminution in the spiritual intensity of how we related to Hashem. And that's why the Gemara says, in fact, the Gemara says today that even people that are Oved Avodah Zarah, it actually says, are only doing so because that was the minhag of their communities. It's not the same passion. One little thing I will tell you, though, that Buddhism, which unfortunately, Buddhists will deny it, but the Pashtus, Buddhism seems to be an Avodah Zarah. And Buddhism does have a lot of converts from Western countries, English-speaking countries. And 9 out of 10 English-speaking converts to Buddhism are Jewish. 9 out of 10, 90%. That's an amazing thing, very disheartening thing. But on the other hand, I think there's something optimistic about it. Because people leave secular culture and into Buddhism because they are spiritual seekers. They're looking for something beyond the material. They don't want the life where all you're doing is making money and rat race and professional advancement. They want to find meaning and purpose. Now the problem is, in the Judaism they have been exposed to, they see superficiality, they see materialism, money, and everything else. So the trick is, so to speak, if they would see that Judaism itself has all of that ruchnius, then they would become maybe the best Jews. In other words, a Jew, what one could say, negative, you've seen this, a Jew that is attracted to Buddhism can actually be the best Baal Tshuva that you can get, because that is a person who is passionately committed to have spiritual renewal in his life. Right? It's a big, on one hand it's a tragedy, on the other hand there's something optimistic in it. Yeah?
As asked this when I went home, do you have a reason behind honey being kosher?
It's an excellent question. Actually, it's a very excellent question. The Gemara discusses the question. Under the typical laws of kashrus, honey should absolutely be treif, because what happens? You have bees. By the way, there's a great shortage of bees worldwide. It's very, very serious. The bee shortage could have absolutely, you don't realize, maybe you do realize, but how important bees are to the world agriculture. But there's a tremendous, bees are dying off in a very mysterious way. We don't even know exactly the cause for the devastation of bees. But be it as it may, it's a very serious problem. no pun intended. But the thing is, you're 100% correct. Honey should absolutely be treif. The bees ingest the nectar, whatever. It gets processed and converted in their body, and then it is emitted as a product, and therefore it would be treif because it's manufactured within the system of a treif animal. The bee is, of course, not kosher. The Gemara ultimately relies on a gezeiras hakosev, because the Torah says, you're gonna ask me a question on this immediately, because it says Eretz Yisrael is described as a land that is flowing of milk and honey, but of course you'll ask me, hey, wait a minute, don't pass that off on me. Honey in that pasuk is date honey. That's true, but the Gemara uses it for bee honey as well. So ultimately it's a gezeira sakosev. But the Gemara gives a little bit of a reason for it by basically saying that since the bee ingests a kosher substance, the nectar from the plant, the flowers, so even though it undergoes processing, but it's foundationally considered to be kosher, and the Torah is therefore considering it to remain kosher even after it goes through the bee's body. Now, where you do get into a very interesting shaila is, you know, bees make a lot of other products besides honey. They make royal jelly. These are different things that basically the drones manufacture, like a special food for the queen, queen bee. Queen bee has a really easy life. She kind of just sits around and everybody worships her and it's really like a very Avodah Zarah type of thing. And it's been discovered in health food stores and the like that royal jelly has a tremendous vitamins and nutrients, and some people, you know, consider it to be the panacea, like for all sicknesses. And there's a big, big machlokas haposkim whether the heter of honey applies to royal jelly, which is technically a different product, but it is manufactured via the ingestion of nectar. So you'll see a big machlokas on that. But if it's stam honey, the Gemara itself tells us it's going to be mutter. But you're right. You need a pusik for it. It's not something you would know automatically.
Do medicines and vitamins, do they need have extra?
Yeah, so here's the thing. If it has a taste, like the royal jelly, you know, it's sweet. It has a taste. So then for sure it needs extra because it's a food, even though it has medicinal properties. But if you're talking about, and that's why syrups, like cough syrups that have a taste, they do have to have a hechsher, or at least you have to know they don't have non-kosher ingredients. And there are, you know, vada kashrus organizations that can tell you about that. With cough syrup, for example, any liquid medicine, a big problem, especially for children's medicine, is grape juice. Grape juice is commonly used as flavoring, and even though grape juice is not from a non-kosher source, but if non-Jews, you know, handle it, it becomes straight. Right, so that's why flavorings would be a problem. Now, if you're, and the same thing with chewable vitamins that have a taste. Now, if you're talking about pills that you just swallow without a taste, or if you're talking about capsules, although they're gelatin capsules, gelatin is not kosher, we just swallow them and they're tasteless. So me'ikir hadin, they do not have to have a hechsher if you're ill. And I'll talk about vitamins in a moment, because this is what is called shelo kederech achilaso. To eat something that has no taste, or a bitter taste, is not the way you normally eat food. And therefore, even though it would be an issur d'rabbanan, the rabbanan didn't make their prohibition b'makom choli. Now, if that's the yesod of the hechsher, you'd have to differentiate between a sick person and a healthy person. Meaning, if I have the flu, even if it's not pikuach nefesh, I have the flu, I have a cold, so I could take these pills without a hashgacha. But what if I'm taking vitamins and the like? Now there it's different. There I'm not a choli, I'm doing it to prevent myself from getting sick or to remain healthy. So there it's better to be machmer. So actually there's more of a makom to be machmer and vitamins than for actual medicines that you take. So bekitzer, if it has a flavoring, whether it's liquid form or whether it is a chewable tablet, then you absolutely have to have a hechsher. If it doesn't have a flavor and it's just swallowed, so then if you're sick, for sure it's okay. If it's a preventative measure, that would be more of a machlokas once you try to have hashgacha. By the way, the same thing is largely true for Pesach. Now, although for Pesach we try to be extra strict, but meikir hadin, non-flavored medicines, like pills, even if they're made with chametz ingredients, you're allowed to have. But again, for Pesach we would try to be extra strict. Because what is the problem? What chametz do you have in pills? Basically, it's only starch. I mean, the active ingredient in medicines is chametz. But pills in particular will have binders, right? Binders that hold it together. Now, the binders, for the most part, are corn. Cornstarch is the most common binder. Cornstarch, for Sephardim, is mutter legamri, and for Ashkenazim, is only kidneyos, which is mutter in medicine. But once in a while there's wheat starch, which is real chametz, but even then, meikir hadin, you know, it would be much of what our custom is to be strict, yeah.
Is there any halachic issues with genetically modified fruits and vegetables?
Well, you know, it depends how you genetically modify them. You know, generally speaking, if it's simply genetic, well, okay. So let's take two situations. One is you want to genetically modify it by the insertion of either a synthesized genetic material or genetic material from another plant or vegetable or fruit stray. So there, the only halakhic issue you would have would be the issue that the Torah prohibits mingling species, right? The Torah prohibits the creation of a nectarine. Now, you can eat nectarines, but you're not allowed to graft different fruits. But here, the poskim say that, once again, going back to the Chazon Ish, since the genetic replication is at the subvisual level, even though it's going to be visible in the final fruits, but the actual thing you're doing is invisible to the naked eye, that wouldn't be a problem. Now, let's say you're not just doing it with vegetable or fruit material, you're doing it with animal material. For example, there was some talk, I don't know exactly what this would have given you, about inserting pig genes in tomatoes. Pig gene in tomatoes. So the question is, does that make my tomato no trafe? Well, once again, we're back to the subvisual issue. You also have the principle it might be batel in much more than 60. Yeah. But there's another concept too, and people have to understand this. When we talk about genetic modification, we're not talking about you take a syringe of pig juice and inject it into a tomato. We're not really, that's not what it is. What you're really talking about is, you're talking about synthesizing. It's like almost like a Xerox machine, a 3D Xerox machine. You're synthesizing, replicating the genetic structure, but it is a laboratory creation. It is not the gene, onasharal, taken from the pig. It's simply a replication or a copy of its DNA structure. So it's not chazer. It's not chazer. You know. So under those circumstances, you'd be allowed to do it. There's going to be a similar question coming up with artificial meat. They can now make meat in a laboratory. They can already do it, meat in a laboratory. And the question becomes, is that fleishik? Now, putting aside Marasayan, which is always, you know, always an issue, but putting aside the Marasayan issue, number one, the question is laboratory meat kosher? It wasn't shechted after all, right? It wasn't shechted. Number two, if it is kosher, is it fleishik or parif, right, so to speak? Do I have to wait six hours? And this really depends. In other words, you have to know exactly how they make it, because there are different ways of making it. Certain ways they make it, it absolutely is meat. For example, one way you can make laboratory meat is by culturing stem cells. By that I mean, through an artificial insemination, animal husbandry, you have sperm, egg, stem cells, you culture the stem cells. Now, it seems to me that that's just regular meat. I mean, you took the sperm of a male and the egg of a female, you created an embryo that produces stem cells. The fact that you then culture the stem cells, you're culturing meat. And that meat wasn't shechted, right? So it would seem to me that that type of meat would actually be treif. You wouldn't be allowed to eat it at all because it would be a nevela. On the other hand, if you're creating the meat by laboratory synthesis of the molecules, then it would appear you have a new entity. It's not meat, right? So you can't really give an answer about is laboratory meat, you know, kosher or not, unless you define with very, very great precision what is the process by which that meat is made. Because there are different ways you can make it. Some of them would be meat, and some of them would be a new artificial entity. Yeah.
I wanted to ask, why has Jewish society as a whole across the board moved towards being more mocker in the last 50 years? I guess what's the problem with being mocker?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if I would describe it as Jewish society as a whole.
Sure.
Remember, we still have. No.
Okay, yeah. I'm talking about.
Yeah, I understand the religious. Right. Yeah. Well, it is a good question. There's no question that among, let's say, the more observant, there's been a tendency to be more machmir and more strict and more rejecting of outside influences than may have been the case 20, 30, 40 years ago, even in matters of dress, just to take a very superficial example. If you look at the pictures of, you know, great rabbis, I saw a picture of Rav Steinman as a either a bacher or a young married man in mirror. You know, he looked very much the dapper European gentleman. This was in Switzerland, you know, wearing, you know, like a fancy suit, a striped shirt, you know, etc. The notion that you have to be dressed in black was absolutely not, black and white, was absolutely not the case in Mir and Slobodka and the like. So why there's been the tendency to be stricter in so many areas is a good question, but I would say two things. I would say, number one, some of it is still a result of the Holocaust, and that is the Holocaust, besides that, I mean, of course, the tragedy of 6 million Jews, but above the tragedy of 6 million Jews was also the almost the total destruction of a world of Torah, a world of Kedusha, Gedolim, Yeshivos. It's like the whole Jewish world was not only numerically desiccated, but spiritually. And therefore, there was a push that we have to be stronger, we have to be stricter, we have to make up, we have to... and that's why Kollel became a much bigger idea. Kollel became a much broader idea after the Holocaust than before the Holocaust. Before the Holocaust, there were very few Kollelim. Before the Holocaust, I mean, there were people learning, but essentially it wasn't like advocated for everybody. After the Holocaust, you know, the Chassid said, we have to rebuild. Whoever we can get into learning, we have to get into learning. So part of it is trying to rebuild after the Holocaust. Part of it, however, is it is a reaction to the increasing secularization and decadence of the world. The truth of the matter is, the world, okay, is a much more immoral place than it was 50 years ago. You know, the concept of women covering hair, right? Married woman covers hair. Well, in colonial times, and even afterwards, in the 1800s in America, no, a non-Jewish married woman would not walk in the street with their hair uncovered. In other words, it wasn't even a Jewish thing, although the halacha always was that way. It was a universally understood expression of modesty. And when I was growing up, I could make a reference to the television of the 60s, you know, they could not show in the 1960s, they could not show a bedroom on television, even with twin beds. They were not allowed to show it. The notion of husband and wife, whatever it would be. Now, what has happened in the past 30 years, 40 years, is called the sexual revolution, whatever you want to call it, is there's been an absolute breakdown in any sense of morality, propriety. The notion of living together before marriage is a commonplace. It doesn't even raise a shudder or a surprise. So there is a concept that when society gets more corrupt, gets more decadent, then we need to compensate by a certain strictness in our behavior. When society is less decadent, right, so we can be a little more relaxed. Also, I should say, too, that a lot of things are reactions. For example, feminism has made a lot of inroads with the rabbis, you know, women being ordained as rabbis. So a lot of this is, you know, there's kind of a circle the wagons mentality. Now, in many ways, that's good. In many ways, the idea that Judaism has gotten stronger is a wonderful thing. But it does have some negative side effects. The negative side effects are maybe less Avas Yisrael, less acceptance of people, less loving and caring of people, more kind of caring about your own little group, because we have to protect our group because there's so much evil out there. And that is something that's very sad, that there's been a diminution of that. But the two reasons I would suggest for what you're saying is, number one, the Holocaust, and number two, the increasing demoralization of society, which affects everybody. It actually affects everybody. Yeah.
We asked Rosinda to translate the passage of Bashamra differently on Friday night and Shabbos morning.
Our translation?
Yeah.
Yeah, what do they say? What's the difference?
On Friday night it says, Bashamra is also, children of Israel will observe Shabbos.
Yeah. Anyone has a sitter? Let's hear.
Shabbos says they have observed that. It's a tense.
about the normal pockle?
It's actually a chance.
That's okay.
It says, on Friday night, and the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath.
Shall keep, yep.
And then it's...
then Shabbos Day you're looking at?
Yeah. So Shabbos Day, it says, and the children of Israel shall observe.
Oh, keep versus observe.
No, it was different in the one I saw.
Yeah, yeah, you have to check. You know, these every article edition is different. And,
okay.
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. I mean, keep and observe, I don't think they intended a difference, but you are correct. In a good translation, you try to be consistent between pages, and this was an editorial oversight. You know, I want to tell you that even sometimes this can be a serious thing. You know, in the Mishnah Berurah, there are sometimes contradictions in the Mishnah Berurah. And the explanation that is given for why there are contradictions in the Mishnah Berurah is that the Chafetz Chaim did not write every word of the Mishnah Berurah. The Chafetz Chaim was the primary writer and the editor-in-chief. But he delegated sections of the Mishnah Berurah to his sons and sons-in-law and some very, very close Talmidim who were great, great Talmidei Chachamim. And the Chafetz Chaim officially, you know, had oversight over the project. But what happens is, sometimes, you know, nobody gets everything, right? And therefore, as a result, since there were different authors, they sometimes came out different names. So what probably happened was that there may have been different translators for different portions, and they didn't go over it with a fine-tooth comb. That happens in the actual Gemara as well. The actual Gemara, of course, that's even more obvious. Every article Gemara has a number of translators, right? They're listed. Every Maseches has usually four or five translators. You know, this guy did Perek Aleph, and this guy did Perek Beis, etc. In fact, I know a person who his life stream was he wanted to translate one Amud for Israel. He, you know, he couldn't. You know, he was not even a Talmud Chacham, but he just wanted to do. You know, he wanted to do one Amud, so they actually gave him like a short Amud of Ksuvas that he translated. But if you look, there is an editor-in-chief, it's Rabbi Moritz, who lives in Ramat Beit Shemesh here. He was the editor-in-chief of Artsville. And one of the jobs of an editor is to assume consistency of translation of terms. And an editor tries to be sure that Hacha B'mayas Kinen, an idiom like that, is translated the same way every time it appears. And that's the goal, but sometimes, you know, you make a mistake. So that's probably what happened there. Yeah.
So, in understanding that third night of Malach is the Shabbos, and kind of like the month of El, and understanding that we're each an individual Mishkan, how do the third night of Malach is really how we build ourselves?
Well, that's that's a massive question. Your point, though, is a very well-taken point, because we actually say that every person is a Mishkan, right? We are a tabernacle for the divine presence. And as a result, every physical activity that goes into the building of the tabernacle does correspond with an aspect of spiritual work we should do it ourselves. So I would suggest that would be a great idea for a sefer that you should write. Because as far as I know, we don't have a sefer that comprehensively analyzes. I mean, I'll give you an example of one or two. But to do it 39 systematically, that's a great idea for a sefer. So maybe that's it. But I'll give you an example. Let's take the first two. Choresh, to plow, and then Zoreya, to plant. So they say, the Mephoshim say, Choresh is to make the earth soft and receptive for planting. So within a human being, our earthly disposition, called the Yetzer Hara, our desire for physical pleasure, is something that is very hard to receive God's light. So plowing is when you prepare yourself by working on your being less attached to the physical, softening yourself up, so you'll be able to receive the seeds of Torah that will grow, you see? And therefore, things like that. So choresh is to soften up and control and manage and subjugate the physicality within man. Planting is to bring in the light of Torah, spirituality, into your neshama. Harvesting is when you then are able to act on it, etc. right? But as I say, it's only 3 out of 39, so you have to keep on going. But that's but you're correct. I think your instinct is absolutely correct. Yeah. Yes.
I was at the paradigm that meaning like a person became a Talmud Chacham, and then afterwards, if he was worthy, he could become a prophet. But then, when you read in Brachos, like at the end of the fifth period, it seems to be that the Gemara says like the Nevi'im like only gave prophecy in order to like marry off their daughters to a Talmud Chacham, and so it makes you think like so Talmud Chacham has a higher level, so to speak, a prophet. So I was just wondering, is that correct statement, or I guess my question would be, what is the
So I would suggest, I think maybe you're a tiny bit mistranslating the statement. When it says in the Gemara, the Nevi'im gave their prophecies to marry the daughter to a Talmud Chacham, the Gemara doesn't mean that the Navi gave his prophecy so he could marry his daughter to a Talmud Chacham. He's already a Talmud Chacham. It means like this. The Gemara is just saying the following. The Nevi'im describe wonderful schar for people. Right? Rewards. So it says, all of the reward that they can describe is for the person who connects to Torah in an indirect way by marrying his daughter to a Talmud Chacham. But if he is a Talmud Chacham, that's indescribable. In other words, it's not referring to the Nevi'im themselves, it's referring to who are they talking about when they are promising Gevaldige rewards. And the answer is secondary connections to Torah. But when there's a primary connection to Torah, like a Talmud Chacham, that's infinite. That's not even describable by the promise. That's what the Gemara means. But you are correct. I mean, generally speaking, Nevuah, at least the Rambam says, based on many Gemaras, that Nevuah is not stam a gift that you're walking in the street and you get zapped with Nevuah. But Nevuah is a gift that, it's not automatic in any case, but it's a gift that God gives you when you have perfected your midos and you're great in Torah. So then the next step is a person might be zocha to Nevuah. So you cannot get Nevuah as an Am Haaretz, and you also cannot get Nevuah except for Bilam. Bilam was the big exception. You cannot get Nevuah without extraordinary midos of character and goodness. That's correct. Yeah.
Do you from Yidden in Eretz Yisrael have any clue whatsoever to attempt to join politics to try to bring some Torah to the government? Not that I don't want to join politics. But do from Yidden in general have any clue to at least try to bring some Torah to the government?
Well, you know, first of all, if you take the position like the Eda Charedis, that they don't recognize the legitimacy of the State of Israel, then they would have no chiyuv to be involved in the government because they consider it to be an illegitimate state. But I think generally, like everything else, I wouldn't describe it as a chiyuv to governments per se. We have a chiyuv. Part of our chiyuv as Jews is to try to make our society, or improve our society and our environment, to make it more of a place where it's a Kiddush Hashem. Now, if you look at it in terms of my environment, my society, right, my community, so then every person has to then make an individual decision as to in what way can I do this the best. Some people might find it through political activism. Some might find it through creating yeshivas or shuls or shiurim within their own community. In other words, I would just subsume political activism to be a chelek of trying to make a Kiddush Hashem in your environment, and then you have to define what is the best way. Now, I think as a general rule, the Gedolim have said, although it's a bit controversial, that a Jew should try to be mashpia on the government to become more of a Jewish state. That's why there are elections. I mean, that's why Gedolim call upon us to vote. Otherwise, we just say don't vote, etc. But I would think it's really a part of how do you create a society that is more faithful to our Kodesh Baruch Hu. And politics is part of that society, but not the whole thing. Yeah.
I have a follow-up question to the Slivkas.
Yes.
It sounds, based on what the Rev said, like all of the ideas that Rev Slivkin communicated were technically kosher, but could easily, without proper diligence, lead to unkosher ideas. Is that correct?
Again, I want to repeat, that is my view.
Okay.
Not everybody will agree with me.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, in that case, the excommunication seems a little bit patronizing, kind of like this. Oh, we're gonna tell you not to read this because we think you're too stupid to use your brain and, you know, differentiate between kosher and what's not kosher. So we're gonna say that this is also not kosher, and then we narrow out what's kosher.
Well, yeah, patronizing is putting a label on it, but I mean, basically you have to understand that, you know, when you're a gadol or Rosh Hashiva, you know, you have a responsibility for Klal Yisrael, you know, and there might be all sorts of things that are possible ideas, debatable ideas, but one makes a decision as to what is likely or what is, you know, has a strong probability of, you know, having possible negative effects, you know. There is a concept. Again, this is really the debate. In other words, this is why there is some level of censorship going on. And one might present it. And that's why I would suggest, too, that the Cherem in particular was addressed much more to Israeli people than Americans. Because the Haredi, the Israeli Haredi, is brought up in a relatively closed society where there's very little exposure to ideas outside of Torah. An American typically has much greater exposure. And when you're exposed to Api courses, you need to have answers. In other words, the concept would be that those who are not troubled with certain problems shouldn't open themselves up to them. Those who are troubled, you know, need to respond. You know, that's kind of what's going on. But yeah, I understand. I mean, you can call that patronizing, you can call it censorship, but it is undertaken, at least with the idea that sometimes you have to make those decisions in order to protect your people. There was a biography of Yaakov Kamenetsky, The Making of a Gadol. Maybe you heard of this. It was written by Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky's son, Rav Nassim Kamenetsky, who is a Rosh Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael and a Talmud Chacham. And this book was banned. This book was banned. And he even did a revised edition, and the second one was banned as well. Now, you should know that banning a book is sometimes the best way to get people to read it. You know, the book was available for $25. And after it was banned and it was withdrawn from bookstores, some people were selling it on eBay for $1,000. $1,000, yeah. Now, what's wrong with the biography of Yaakov Kamenetsky? Because Rav Nassim actually went into all of the details of the struggles of B'nai Torah without even Gedolim, like, you know, Rav Aaron Cutler, for example, liked Dostoevsky in the original Russian. Rav Aaron Cutler used to read Dostoevsky, you know. Something like that. Or Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, you know, studied math. Now, all right, you know, these are things, you know, I mean, these are, you know, from our perspective, these don't sound like the most awful things. But there were people who felt, you know, we don't have to tell our B'nai Torah that Gedolim did this, right? So, yeah, I mean, I'm not justifying the decision, but from a certain perspective, they just felt that we have created a certain world, and this world has been very successful at creating holy people and righteous people. And sometimes when you expose people to too many different ideas, they don't know how to deal with them properly, and they don't know how to balance them properly. Which is why I think an American really is dealing with a whole different set of questions, you know. Again, I'll give you an example going back to earlier history. You know, the Rambam wrote the Sefer Mora Nevuchim, Guide to the Perplexed. And who were the perplexed people the Rambam was addressing? He was addressing people who had strong grounding in Aristotelian philosophy, which was the philosophy of the Middle Ages, and they couldn't reconcile the tenets of philosophical truth with Judaism. And as a result, they couldn't believe in Judaism. So the Rambam tried to build a bridge between Aristotelian philosophy and Judaism, by logically proving the existence of God and divine providence and everything else. Now, you do know that there was great controversy about the Rambam's Mora Nevuchim, and in fact there were Jewish communities that burnt the Rambam's Sfarim, Mora Nevuchim. Now, why is that so? The Rambam is holy, the Rambam is great, everybody knows that. But the answer was that if people didn't have questions about belief in God, why do you give them the questions, which then makes them, you know, skeptical? Better not to ask the questions if you don't have the questions. Now, that is why, if you look in your base medrash here, or the main base medrash, or the mirror base medrash, you'll have plenty of Mishnah Torahs on the bookshelf. But, ask the Mashgiach, where can I find the Mora Nevuchim? They may kick you out of Yeshiva, you know, for even asking the question. Now, we have a Mora Nevuchim somewhere, one of the sub-basins here. We have a Mora Nevuchim. And the like. But it's the same Rambam who wrote the Mishnah Torah that every year, you know, we quote the Rambam, wrote Mora Nevuchim. But the short answer is, those who have those questions need those answers. But sometimes people who don't have those questions don't need to get into it. You see what I'm saying? So in many ways, that's the same thing with the Slifkin issue, and it's the same thing with the making of a Gadol. And that's why I think American guys are positioned very differently than people who were raised in the Israeli Haredi society. Now, Lemaisa, okay, I think there's a problem to have that censorship even for Israeli Haredim, because eventually they get curious and they come across things, especially with that website I mentioned before, which is Mamish Mesis and Mediach. I think people need some answers, but at least that's kind of the justification, the distinction between people who have questions need answers, but we don't need to introduce questions to people who don't have those doubts.
I was wondering if you knew anything about with books. Apparently, I've been hearing that after a while, the reserving of their rights becomes like open to the public or public open. Is there such a concept of that?
Yeah, there absolutely is such a concept. I always forget. It's like 50 years or 60 years. You know, they sometimes extend it, but sure, this is called public domain. And for example, I mean, this is halakhic as well. If you wanted to reprint a Gemara, now Gemara doesn't. Nobody owns the copyright on Gemara. Now, the different Gemaras that have different features that were put in, you know, that you can't do. But you know, you could do your own Gemara and the like. So copyright does expire after a certain number of years, and we find this throughout Jewish history when printers would print something, so they would get a letter from the rabbi that said, nobody can reprint this for 25 years or 30 years. And after those 30 years, they were able to do it. So there is something called the public domain for these books. You know, there is I don't know, I shouldn't encourage you guys to go to the internet. The internet is so much bad stuff. But there is a website on the internet, HebrewBooks.org. In fact, some of you may have heard Rabbi Reisman last week, or Tzvi Reisman from Los Angeles. He gave a shiur in the Beis Medrash. He's an amazing person. He's a very successful businessman and a great Talmud Chacham, and he's written many, many Sfarim. And he is also the one who supports the HebrewBooks.org. Now, HebrewBooks.org has put 50,000 Sfarim online for free. And you can access it and print it and search them. It's the most amazing thing, you know. Ktsos, the Sivis, like everything, you have a whole huge library of stuff. So all of those are not copyrighted anymore. So you can kind of, you know, take what you want. Okay, I have one more question and I'm going to go. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk about the history of the Mishnah Berurah in comparison to the Ark of Shulchan.
That's a fascinating question. You know, first of all, you know, the end of the 19th century produced two great, great codes of Jewish law. Mamish, great, great sources of Psak Halacha. One is the Mishnah Berurah, one is the Aruch HaShulchan. The Mishnah Berurah was authored by the Chafetz Chaim of Radin. The Aruch HaShulchan was authored by Rabbi Yechiel Michal Halevi Epstein, who was a brother-in-law of the Netziv, and the father of the Torah Tamima, if you're familiar with the work, the Torah Tamima. One very important difference between the Aruch HaShulchan and the Mishnah Berurah is the Mishnah Berurah is a commentary on only the first part of the Shulchan. All six volumes are only a commentary on Aruch Chaim, Shabbos, Yom Tov, and the like. There is no Mishnah Berurah on Yorei Deah, about Kashrus, Evan Ezer, Choshen Mishpat. The Aruch HaShulchan is on everything. Right? So you can only compare the Mishnah Berurah and the Aruch HaShulchan for Aruch Chaim because the Mishnah didn't wasn't able. And like he said, if Hashem would give him 20 more years, he would do it on the rest of the Shulchan as well. The other is the style. The Mishnah Berurah is written as a commentary on the actual text of the Shulchan Aruch. So you have the text of the Shulchan Aruch, the text of the Ramah, and the Mishnah Berurah. The Aruch HaShulchan is written as an autonomous work. It's a separate, independent work, and it's very, very beautifully written. He'll start with the Gemara and tell you Rashi says this, Tosfos says this, the Rambam says this. In other words, he actually takes you from the Gemara all the way. So stylistically, it's a very, very different sefer. Now, in terms of bottom line psak, it is well known that the Aruch HaShulchan tends to be more lenient than the Mishnah Berurah. Although that's not always the case, the truth of the matter is it may be the Aruch HaShulchan is more deferential to minhagim, which tended to be lenient, but really the Iker was the minhag. When the minhag was to be machmer, the Aruch HaShulchan is actually more machmer than the Mishnah Berurah. It is said that Rav Moshe Feinstein held that the Aruch HaShulchan was a more definitive posek than the Mishnah Berurah. He considered the Chafetz Chaim to be the tzaddik of the generation, and the Aruch HaShulchan was the posek of the generation. And I am told that before World War II, before the Holocaust in Europe, by and large, the Aruch HaShulchan was considered to be the definitive posek in all of these things. Now, by and large, in the yeshiva world, that has changed today. And really, there are two people to whom, who are really responsible for this change. One was the Chazon Ish in Eretz Yisrael, and the other was Rav Aaron Cutler in America. And again, they maintained that because of the Chafetz Chaim's sitkus and holiness, his hachra'ah, his final psak, should be regarded as definitive. And once again, you might look at it as maybe, once again, going back to the idea that post-Holocaust, we needed to intensify our standards in various ways. So the Mishnah Berurah became, in the world of the yeshivas at least, the posek ha'acharon. Although it's quite tricky. It's hard to get a psak from the Mishnah Berurah sometimes. Sometimes it brings different opinions and doesn't tell you exactly. So it's not so much. That's why Rav Chaim Kineski wrote a kitzer of the Mishnah Berurah called Shona Halachos. He tries to extract from the Mishnah Berurah and the Chazon Ish what a final psak is. Nevertheless, so I say the minhag in the Torah, in the yeshiva world at least, is to try to be somech on the Mishnah Berurah. But still, one has to be makir that the Aruch HaShulchan was regarded as a tremendous, tremendous gadol in psak. And if you follow the Aruch HaShulchan consistently, you will certainly not go to Gehenna. I mean, it's just, he is a bar samcha that one could be somech on. But again, I do want to caution you generally that it is very, very dangerous to simply say, oh, I'm going to follow the Aruch HaShulchan or something, because sometimes you may not understand what the Aruch HaShulchan is saying, and you need to talk to a Rav or a Posek about whether that's appropriate, simply because we sometimes misunderstand. Let me just mention one very famous controversy between the Aruch HaShulchan and the Mishnah Berurah. It's a very famous controversy. We know that married women are supposed to cover their hair, right? That's a halacha. And there's another halacha that you're not allowed to read Kriya Shema or Daven or learn in front of any woman, even your own wife, whose hair is not properly covered. Now the Aruch HaShulchan has a psak that says, since Bizman Hazeh, unfortunately, many women do not cover their hair, so it is no longer erotic, it is no longer sexually stimulating. You are allowed to read Kriya Shema even in front of a woman that has uncovered hair. Now, people misunderstand that. A lot of people are going to quote the Aruch HaShulchan that says, oh, since so many women don't cover their hair and it's not erotic, women don't have to cover their hair anymore. That is absolutely false. That is absolutely false. The Aruch HaShulchan certainly says married women have to cover their hair, but he does say you're allowed to read Kriya Shema Daven and learn in front of a woman with uncovered hair. Now, the Mishnah Berurah seems to be chaylik on that. Legend has it, and I think it is a legend, that the reason the Chafetz Chaim never quotes the Aruch HaShulchan, even though they were coming out at the same time, is the Chafetz Chaim felt that was such a pritzus in the laws of Tznius, he did not want to even quote the Aruch HaShulchan on anything, not to give legitimacy. Now, the reason why I think that's not emes is the Mishnah Berurah never quotes anybody that was alive at the time. There's no contemporary posek the Mishnah Berurah quotes. He only quotes poskim that are dead. You know, so you can't bring a raya because he didn't want to. The Chafetz Chaim didn't want to, especially the Chafetz Chaim was makbid on Lashon Hara, right? He didn't want to get into the business of, he quotes some poskim and not other poskim. So the Chafetz Chaim had a klal, he would not quote the poskim of his generation. The one exception, in the Be'er Halacha, he quotes the Or Sameach once. And they have a story that he got into a machlokes with the Meir Simcha, and this was his way of asking mechila. Indirectly. Because they were arguing over, the Or Sameach maintained that a Rav had to know Russian and learn the language of the country. The Chafetz Chaim was against it, and they got into a bit of a bitter machlokes, and this was the Chafetz Chaim's bakashas mechila. Be it as it may, this is a famous machlokes. Now, Mimela, in Eretz Yisrael, many poskim follow the Mishnah Berurah, but in America, most poskim follow Rav Moshe's psak, who says you follow the Aruch HaShulchan. Right, so that would be an example. Okay, I'm going to say evening.
Thank you so much.